podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
I'm Sam Keir, host of Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. For the past 12 months, I've been talking to T20 star David Visa, getting his take from behind the scenes at the IPL, the 100 and the rest of the world's biggest leagues.
That's the Donnelly view system, Diogis. There's no ways in my mind that was up.
These guys don't know how to win at this stage.
He had his driver pick him up in his Bentley.
People start chanting your name. You kind of have to pinch yourself.
Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Sport Social.
It is the Anfield Wrap. Neil Atkinson with Paul Senior, with Emma Sanders and with Lizzie Doyle. And to come to talk about the passing of Gerard Houllier, I've got Rob Gutman and Ali McGovern to look back on that period when Gerard Houllier was Liverpool manager. Just briefly before we get into that with them in a little while, Paul, before we speak about Villa and the cup draw and the game against Tottenham. On Gerrard, it's remarkably sad, it's remarkably sudden in one sense. His tenure as Liverpool manager was one which, for people who are of, and I'll use our age broadly because you are younger than me, so I'll be generous towards myself, but of people who are our age, it's hard really to genuinely quantify the importance of Gerrard Houllier to our Liverpool support and growing up lives.
Yeah, obviously it's pretty fresh this as we're recording, but... I was just saying off air then that he's the first. I remember Roy Evans being manager. I remember going to a match while Roy Evans was manager, but Houllier's sort of the manager that takes you, that took me heart a little bit, you know, and just the transformation of the club really from one that was competitive under Evans. I think, you know, we finished third a lot under Roy, but Gerrard brought us in line with what was happening at Arsenal. What was happening at Manchester United under Fergie, and just transformed us in the way we were. Because Liverpool, although, you know, the gaps between winning titles and stuff at that time wasn't as big, and that was never really a conversation. Manchester United were obviously the emerging force in terms of just winning back-to-back titles all the time when he was first the manager, and there was clearly a problem at Liverpool that on and off the pitch we were being left in the past. And he halted that straight away, quite ruthlessly, I must say. In terms of, if you didn't meet the standards of what Gerrard envisaged for Liverpool Football Club, you were gone. And I mean, what a journey it was with him. I think obviously 2001 was a great time, and it was my first time really of remembering Liverpool winning trophies. You know, we won the League Cup under Roy, didn't we? I think we won in my lifetime. I'm born 87, and I think we win the FA Cup in 92, do we? Something
soon as yet.
And but that was it really. And to go from that to winning, I remember I was at Cardiff for the I wasn't at the 2001 FA Cup final. I was at the League Cup final for Birmingham, and then I remember my dad going to Dortmund for the Alaves game, and it felt a little bit like how it feels now in terms of the amount of sort of green shoots you were seeing from the team at the time. You thought, oh, we're back almost, you know. We never quite got to that title winning thing under Gerrard, but by God, he went close, and he did everything else, didn't he? It was wonderful.
You did indeed do everything else. Very quickly, Lizzie, Emma, because one of the things Lizzie said when she arrived was, I don't remember much of Gerrard being manager, but I remember the trophy parade, which I just think if there's one sentence that Gerrard would quite like to actually hear it, it'd be, well, I don't remember much of the managerial time, but I remember all the trophies.
Go on, Emma.
Yeah, I was saying to Lizzie, you know, it's a weird one because he's the first Liverpool manager that I remember, but I only remember him and his games and sort of his seasons in bursts. So my sort of fondest memory was the, you know, the FA Cup win over Arsenal, the Michael Owen double, because Michael Owen was my childhood hero at the time. So it's one of those where I can't really tell you much about his tenure as a whole. Obviously, I've learnt that in hindsight. I've learnt it with it, you know, the history of it. But I went to my first Liverpool game in 2003. Obviously, he was manager there, and like I said, you know, he was responsible for that treble winning season, which for my sort of childhood heroes growing up, which might be the same as you, Lizzie, you know, it was the Carragers, it was the Owens when they were young, it was the Gerrards when they were coming through. So he has a special place in my kind of childhood memories, I'd say. Obviously, the time since then that I've been supporting Liverpool, you know, I've learnt more about kind of the identity of other managers and more about their personality, but Gerrard Houllier will always be the manager that was in charge of my childhood team, and for me that's something that's really special.
Yeah, Robbie Fowler, Michael Owen, all them, like, even though I wasn't like really into football around the age of 7 or 8, I knew everything that was going on, and that was because of how good Liverpool were at that time. And you just saying there about your dad going to Dortmund, I remembered it, and I was saying to Emma upstairs, my dad used to bring me back a teddy from my whole like the European aways and stuff like that, and he brought me back this boss little dog and I called it Dortmund. And there's just I have like really like little snippets of like memories of things happening with my family rather than necessarily Hooley. I remember it like Phil Thompson taking over and stuff like that and him being unwell, and I remember when he come back, I remember watching that on the telly and just feeling like really happy for like the likes of, you know, like my dad and my brother who were going the footy, but to see him well. But you just got little memories of like, I remember singing the Gary Mack song in Spain with my mum over and over again, and it's just really, really sad news, to be honest.
Just very quickly, Paul, it was unbelievable in the ground when the night he came back into Rome, yeah. And it was genuinely like, there's two or three times around Hooley, I'll always remember the Leeds away in the fourth round of the FA Cup as just being like, it's the away end that for me they're all measured against, and rarely, rarely is it reached. Obviously it helps the numbers and it helped the nature of the competition, it helped it with Leeds, it helped it kicked off about 10:30 in the morning. Loads and loads of madness, but it was genuinely incredible. And that night when he came back against Roma was also similarly incredible.
Yeah, I'll never forget. You know, I don't think Fabio Capello's particularly known for his warmness. And I remember how happy Capello was to see him on that night. And I mean, the atmosphere in the ground speaks for itself. The one that really got me emotionally with Hooley is the game afterwards. I remember being, I can't remember if it was the immediate game afterwards or not, but the first home game afterwards. And just, do you know what, I sit right in the middle of the cop in 206, and when that flag was, the big flag that goes across the ground was going over your head, and we were singing Ale, Ale, Gerard Hooley, and honestly I was in bits, in absolute bits. And do you know what, I'm trying to think, what year is that, Neil? Is that 2000, is it? So I'm about 12, 13 at the time, but there's grown men around me in worse conditions than I was, and I think that tells you sort of how people felt about him. And I think if you look at the period under Phil Thompson, where Phil was the manager there, like Phil, I don't think he managed another club, did he?
No,
and the record under him was unbelievable, and you could see that there was solidarity around Gerard and just how much the players loved him. I think he had a very similar relationship to the one that's quite often taking the mick out of with the Chelsea players and Mourinho, where he was like some players' dads in that dressing room. And I think he meant the world to the likes of Steven Gerrard, Michael Owen. You know them boys will be suffering today. You can see in some of the quotes that are going out on the likes of Twitter and stuff, like it was a genuine friendship, father-like relationship, and I think you know, he's a great loss to this football club for sure.
Yes, indeed. We'll move on and we'll talk about Fulham 1, Liverpool 1. And we'll break that one down. As I say, we'll get to the cup draw where we've got Leipzig, and we will have a chat about Spurs as well. And as I said, there'll be more on Hooley with Ali McGovern and Rob Gutman. That is to come very, very soon indeed. But we will start with Fulham 1, Liverpool 1. And Emma, Liverpool, very poor feels like an understatement for what Liverpool were first 30. It's amongst the worst half an hour's of football they've played since the start of the 2018-19 season, frankly. It's comparable with a few others. It made me think, some people said Watford, it actually reminded me a bit of Red Star Belgrade away, where they were just utterly discombobulated and couldn't find a way through. But it's hard to put into words precisely how poor Liverpool were.
Well, you just used an amazing word, so let's go with that one. Yeah, it was such a poor start. It was such a poor first half in general. Liverpool just didn't look at the races. Fulham seemed to take confidence from that, and they seemed to build upon that in the first half. They grew with confidence, and you know, they start to have a go at Liverpool, and they thought, you know what, if there's any time to beat them, it's when they're clearly not playing very well. And they sensed that, and Liverpool just couldn't get the tempo. There was no intensity. I thought Jordan Henderson and Curtis Jones were our best two players on the pitch. In the first half, Curtis Jones sort of, you know, stepped up even more so in the second half. But apart from the kind of the sideways pass, I think Fabinho to Matip, it was just, they were just passing it to and from each other. And there was no direction, there was no urgency. Jurgen Klopp was going mental on the sidelines. So it was just one of those games where they just never got going.
It's a strange one, Lizzie, in that Fulham were flying, and I had a little look at Fulham before the game, and a lot of their issues and weakness have actually been first 15 minutes, and Liverpool just give them an endless amount of encouragement. It's spectacular to me, this team that we praise, its game intelligence and its ability to manage through difficult periods even. That had gone, you know, they were in a difficult period and it became more difficult. I thought the first 15 minutes was bad. The 15 minutes that followed was far worse. And you just end up in this scenario going, I do not understand why nobody on this pitch can genuinely get a grip of this game.
It was strange. It felt a little bit like Aston Villa, to be honest. It was like there was just something up and it was with all of them. And thank God we had Alisson in goal is all I'm saying. Because tell you what, those first, what was it, two saves weren't it in the first 15 minutes or so, which kept them out, and they just did not look up for it. And I think a lot of people will probably talk about tiredness and stuff like that, and obviously Klopp's being in all his post-match interviews talking about freshness and rotation and injuries and stuff like that. But for me, there was a lot of players that didn't play midweek. So in terms of physical tiredness, I don't think it was that. I think it was more mental. I think they're looking ahead to Spurs as the bigger game, and this was one to sort of get out the way. And I just don't think they had the right attitudes, and that's not me turning up, saying they were turning up and thinking, like, we're not going to play. I just don't think they realised, like, what they were in for, essentially. And Fulham, I think Emma's right, Fulham took complete advantage of it. And I was looking at that first half and I was thinking, God, I don't even know where we scored. I don't know how it happened. It just feels like one of those days. And, you know, there were poor performances across the pitch, especially first half. You know, I thought Trent looked a little bit off. You know, there was that Luchman chance where he sort of doesn't get tight enough to him. And there was just, and that ball, they kept trying that ball to Salah, which just wasn't happening. You know, there's no height in the team, and that ball just wasn't on. But that's all they kept going for in the first half, and especially the second. It was just really frustrating to watch for me.
It is a little bit of two halves, Paul. That's the one thing you'd say. It's not like they suddenly put in football from the gods in the second half and they repeatedly thwarted. Let's not get carried away. But they do sort themselves after 30. They do get a bit of a grip. They do begin to push Fulham back. Fulham don't have a shot after the 70th minute. It's worth pointing all that out. That's not to say it was good enough. Indeed, it's important to say how short the shortcomings were from a Liverpool point of view, how bad they were. But they do manage to get a little bit of a grip of the game in the rest of the first half.
They do, yeah. I mean, I think it's not one for the ages, is it? Certainly not. But I think this time last year we win, and that's the only thing I'm a little bit concerned about, is that Liverpool always found a way. And I mean, if you look at the 11 people that started the game, the attacking threats there, you know. So I don't quite understand why it's not clicking. Obviously, injuries, rhythm, all of that. Yeah, like Lizzie highlights Trent there. I thought it was really strange that Nico Williams felt like a step up from Trent. And I don't know whether that's a fitness issue or rhythm or what, but it just doesn't feel quite right. I mean, when I seen the team, you go, that's a Liverpool team, you know. But it wasn't on the pitch. It certainly wasn't.
Just to come back to you on a few bits that you're sort of saying there, for me, what I couldn't quite get my head around was the extent to which they were struggling to get Sadio Mane in the game, full stop. When they did get him in the game, there was a couple of times he was very impressive driving at the byline. I think he gets Robertson in quite nicely on one occasion as well. But it really did feel as though all of the supply to Mane was cut off, especially in the first 45, but even throughout.
I think, the midfield felt like a problem, but in the second half, your best two midfielders are playing centre-half. So, I mean, what are you meant to do? I think there's a little bit of that, I actually think the change helped us. I didn't know what was going on with Joel Matip at half time, but I said for that last 15 minutes of the first half, we've had all the ball, it's almost like you don't need to play any centre half. Fulham aren't interested now. Henderson and Fabinho are absolutely fine there, but if you're building that basis on Van Dijk and Gomez, you can push really high. You can really squeeze Fulham, because what's going in behind Gomez's recovery pace, for example, allows you to take that bit more of a risk. Trent and Robertson can take that bit more of a risk, because Fabinho might then drop in, make a three or whatever. We can't really do them little triggers that we've got that allow the fullbacks to bomb on, which then in turn makes more space for Salah and Mane to come into the game. I think you've seen a frustrated figure in Sadio Mane yesterday, and I think it's because, well, all these little things that we do that allow, you know, Firmino dropping in, that allows Salah and Mane into the game. There's so many little things that allow them to look unbelievable, but it's the other nine lads on the pitch that are sort of facilitating that. The injuries, and especially at centre-half, and the lack of rest for the lads in midfield are now starting to have an impact on them. And I think that's what you're seeing yesterday, is just the way we play is now being affected by square pegs and round holes. And I think we might have to grin and bear this for a while.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of the points there, because I actually think by taking, you know, Van Dijk out of the side, you miss his sort of delivery from that deep lying position, where he often cuts through two or three players with a pass from, you know, across midfield. And I think it's that incisive pass that we're perhaps missing from the back. You also take into consideration the pace that Joe Gomez and Van Dijk have, which allows us to have a higher line as well, which, as you say, provides a little bit more space.
I think in games like that, I think you actually miss Gomez more than Van Dijk in the taking the risk category. You know?
Yeah, do you think absolutely. As well, that's why he didn't bring Nath Phillips on? And why you played Henderson, because we saw how, was it Brighton? It was, weren't it? We just felt like we were playing so much deeper with Nath Phillips, because he's that sort of traditional centre-half. He's not a Liverpool centre-half, but with Henderson, like, obviously he's got much more pace.
Yeah.
But it was just mad seeing two central midfielders playing at the back when you've got a centre-half on the bench, and just thinking that you're missing Jordan Henderson in the midfield. You're missing the energy in midfield other than from Curtis Jones.
Yeah, definitely. And I agree with that energy, you know, comment as well, because I did think, even in the first half when I said that Jordan Henderson for me was one of our better players, he was still dropping so, so deep. And it was almost like he felt he had to drop deep to get the ball. Now, I don't think you can sugarcoat it for me. Like, Firmino had a really, really tough game as well. And so not only are you missing the delivery from Van Dijk and Gomez at the back, not only are you missing that higher line, not only are you missing Jordan Henderson, you know, in that midfield position, you're missing Firmino being able to drop deep and collect the ball, because his first touch was horrendous. He couldn't hold the play up. He wasn't bringing others into play around him. So you then kind of left with the responsibility on the fullbacks. And as we said, you know, Trent just wasn't at it either. So Robertson ended up, for me, taking too many risks, and then he was then getting caught out of position, and he was keeping people onside. So, you know, it was almost like a knock-on effect of all these different things coming together.
What one of the things I noticed that happens early, and I think it takes us the whole of the half to sort of recover from, Paul, was Loftus-Cheek. Loftus-Cheek goes and plays in the gap between Robertson and Fabinho. Mm. He gives Fabinho a big headache, and that's why Henderson ends up dropping and swaps sides. So Henderson comes and plays right in front of Loftus-Cheek, whereas if that is Van Dijk, or if Gomez is on the pitch, you know, I like Fabinho an awful lot at centre-half, and I actually think there's a long-term future for him in the position, to be quite honest. But he's going to have to get used to what you do when the lad who's 6'4" comes and stands on your toes. It's hard, but that's the thing that needs to happen there. And we end up moving Wijnaldum, who's got that lovely relationship with Robertson and Mane, moving Henderson, who's just much more comfortable pulling more to the right than to the left. So we move everything to deal with this one problem. And as I say, it took us the whole of the first half to get beyond it.
Well, you're sort of discombobulated. Where this is a good one in terms of summarising everything that was going on. Liverpool were discombobulated. You know, it was I can't believe I've said that twice in the show. You know, there's knock-on effects all over the pitch in terms of how we're shaping up, and Fabinho's got to deal with it. You know, if that's a midfield battle, you'd imagine Fabinho versus Loftus-Cheek, he wins it all day. It should be the same whether it's at centre half or not. But
he was off the boil as much as Firmino, at least for the first half.
You stop Liverpool, you stop the fullbacks. If you look at the Manchester United game that we drew last season, Solskjaer goes five at the back, completely nullified our fullbacks, and Liverpool looked not like nothing compared to what they normally do. Sorry, Neil. The one thing that came into my mind yesterday, and it was a phrase from early on in Klopp's reign, was when we played Swansea. And I can't remember the name of the manager Swansea had at the time, but he said about the Formula One car in
Carlos Carvalho.
That guy. He said about that, and I thought for the first time since Coutinho left, it was that type of performance where Liverpool was just knocking it round, looking for something to happen, and it didn't look on. But the thing is, in that game, Coutinho can put a ball from 30 yards in the top bin and you just win 1-0, but that... We don't really have that. Liverpool make it happen through constant, like, through their own identity, you know, and it's missing at the moment.
It's worth noting, Emma, every European side, bar Leicester in the end, look very, very flat indeed. Leicester have a big first half. They're not brilliant against Brighton, but they very much get the job done and they can cruise. The Manchester derby was startling to me for the lack of legs last 20 minutes. It didn't have a lot of urgency before then, but last 20 minutes, I was amazed people were trying to put it down to a lack of fans. Would fans help? Of course they would, but those players were just trundling around the pitch. Tottenham only come alive, really, at 1-1 against Palace and give it a bit of a last heave. Chelsea utterly frustrated by Everton. We are going to be watching a fair few football matches like this, I think, all of a sudden. We're going to have to... I thought the standard full stop across the league over the course of the weekend. And it isn't just because Liverpool didn't win. If we'd have snatched it 2-1, I'd say the same thing. These are football teams who just do not look themselves at all.
Yeah, I completely agree, especially with the Manchester teams, because City's, for one, you know, that we've had discussions about this at work. It's just, you know... They're a good footballing team. We know this. There's, you know, everyone knows a City can play football, but they've become boring to watch. And that's, you know, I hope I'm not being disrespectful there. It's just everything feels a bit slower these days. You know, Manchester United, they've got so many, you know, attacking players in their side, and yet they lack so much in terms of, you know, entertainment. And yes, they can turn it on in a couple of big games and in European matches against PSG, etc. But they've not really done it for me at all. Tottenham have had a great start to the season, but yeah, I said on a podcast, you know, with you guys last week, that I'm still not convinced by them. There's still something missing there for me with Tottenham. So I think it's going to be a really interesting season. I think this is why loads of people were saying it's perhaps going to be a bit more wide open, because for me, going into the season, taking away coronavirus, injuries, etc., just looking at teams based on their performances last season, Liverpool were still miles ahead of anyone for me. What has now come into play is you've now got to take into consideration the injuries, the fixture schedule, the fact that everything is just not normal. And that in itself, I think, is going to make for a very tough season all round.
I think, bluntly, Manchester City should be in a much better position than they are. When you see that bench that they had yesterday, you're going, I can't believe they gave him another contract. I honestly can't believe that. I know he's Pep Guardiola and what you do after Pep Guardiola, but they've been getting worse every year for the last couple of years. You look at Manchester City and... Even though it was through very jealous eyes, I used to enjoy watching them. I used to enjoy, you know, Sane, Sterling, De Bruyne feeding them, Aguero on fire. And you look at them now, and they were a team with such identity. And Pep would make these mad... You'd get criticised sometimes because he'd take a risk where he'd play, I don't know, three strikers at centre-half or something mad. And you go, but that's the Pep way, isn't it? And so, sometimes it works, and the odd time he gets caught out. But Jesus, they were good to watch. I don't know what they are. I don't know what they're meant to be. And I don't even know what they're meant to be through the players he's signing now.
But they lack sharpness in everything they're doing. But they're not the only ones. We lack sharpness. I'm watching across the division. Tottenham are dead interesting in that what they've had with Kane and Son is players who can just be exceptional for 20 seconds. 20 seconds and suddenly we're ahead in the game. And then we're coming up against a team that lacks... Everyone, to me, sharpness is mental and physical. Yeah. And what I'm looking at, Paul, is I'm looking at footballers who I just don't think look... And it isn't just Liverpool ones, like I say, it really isn't. It's why when you get to see genuine sharpness, you're actually taking... You know, when Grealish is suddenly on it for 15 minutes, you're like, wow, no one else is doing this. I think it's really interesting that, to me, that's the word that's lacking at this point. It's sharpness from a lot of footballers, not just ours.
It may well prove that the manager of the champions isn't an idiot after all, when he's been banging the drum about the quality of the league, that he's been going, you just watch what December's going to bring, and well, we're only just in it, and it hasn't really kicked off yet, and it's about to. I don't know what these Christmas fixtures are going to look like. I think you're talking about the best league in the world, that if you're a fan of, I don't know, Bayer Leverkusen or Sevilla, and you're sitting watching your English football, And that's, you're watching the Manchester derby on Saturday night, and that's the glamour tie from the best league in the world that weekend, you are hugely underwhelmed. That's not the product the Premier League should be putting out, and it's what they're making of it. I must say, this is the season I've enjoyed least in my time watching football. I don't think anyone's having a good time.
I
was just saying, I don't think anyone's having a good time, because we're not seeing good football matches. That Liverpool versus Fulham, Liverpool should have a gear. And whether it's a late goal or whatnot, where Liverpool just overwhelmed Fulham, or Manchester City versus Manchester United, that should be a feisty game. Yeah, and yet derbies aren't what they used to be. But Manchester United have got a point to prove. Manchester City are behind Liverpool and Tottenham in the title race, and it should have been a fight, and it wasn't. It's so placid. It's boring. I'm really, it has to change, and I'm looking forward to once we get back towards the latter stages of the Champions League, when things go back to normal, hopefully the quality comes with it.
I think it's really important to remember the context around it all, and I'm not trying to do a red tinted glasses thing, I'm really not. I just think, like, when if you were to say to any of us at the start of the season, we're going to be in this position with this many injuries and with the season with no fans in COVID, back-to-back fixtures, would you take this position? We'd all say yeah. Mm-hmm. However, I think with the way that they were playing, I mean, when I've questioned their attitudes, I'm not saying that they don't want to play. Probably attitude was the wrong word for me to use. I want to sort of take that back and say that. Focus, but also I think, like, the human beings, like, we're all in this world of 2020 where nothing is normal, and we're all craving that extra little high, you know, bars and restaurants even that you can go to with your family, just anything to give you a bit of joy. And these players, you know, they're living in the same world as we are. The news is still the same for these players, and with all the injuries as well, I mean, imagine being at work and, like, say for example, Paul, like, you had, you know, 4 or 5 bar staff fall sick or something like that, you know, it would have an impact on you, and you'd be worrying about them, you'd be worrying about yourself, and what if something happens to me. I just think there's such a lot hanging over their heads at the moment, and they are only human, and I think it is hard to shake it, even though it is Fulham and we should be at the race, we should be better. I just think they've got a lot to think about.
If you look back to the Liverpool versus Leeds fixture at Anfield, the one thing that was bloody intense.
Yeah,
you know,
it was
intense, both teams going at it, full of energy, sort of the identity of the two managers, and quality prevails and Liverpool win. That's where it is, and that's the Premier League. But you come away from that game going, Leeds, what a team. They're going to upset a few. And I think it's a week later, they do up, I can't remember, was it City or someone? They beat the following week.
They get a 1-1 against City.
They get a 1-1, yeah. But the landing gloves on big teams. So Liverpool had a fright. They take points off City and you go, that's the Premier League. Anyone can beat anyone. But in these games, sometimes quality just prevails, because even the best teams, a Guardiola team, a Klopp team, Mourinho team, whatever, they work hard, they're intense. They'll find a way. You can't beat them in, like, with just energy anymore, you know, on work rate. It's being diluted across the board, and yes, the fixture schedule is doing that, but there's just something wrong in football at the moment where the quality of the fixtures from that point, which isn't that long ago in time, but it's a lot of matches ago, has just dropped off. Klopp's been improved, right?
The whole question is the intensity question, where there's the literal fact of the matter. I ran it with StatsBomb last week and just run through some pressures. You know, the average pressures in a Premier League game per club for the first 11-12 games last season was 170. So far this season, it's run itself at 135, and that's a marked percentage difference. Mm-hmm. Passes per defensive action is down. There was an Athletic piece on it in general. Everyone's sort of aware of it, Emma. We're watching football in a gear below the gear we've watched football in for the last 4 years, and that isn't just quality, but it has the knock-on effect of quality. And I do think it is all about, as Lizzie says, these other factors, the general sense of tiredness and just a complete lack of sharpness that ensues.
Yeah, football is just all-consuming at the moment for these players. You know, your point, Lizzie, about them having all these things over their head, and yet they still have to basically go to work and do the same thing every day, and that is all that they can do. Like, they physically can't do anything else, so they're in a bubble where they're around the same people, around the same players, same staff. They're doing the same thing every day. It's literally play a game, recover. You might get a training session in if you're lucky. Usually it's then just play again, recover, do a bit of media. It's so samey. And, you know, if you think to our day-to-day jobs, you get to a point where you're like, I need a holiday. Now, these players are probably sat there thinking, I'm like, you know, it's difficult because they get paid millions, but as you say, they're still human. They're probably still thinking, I could do with a week without football here, because it is just all that is my life at the moment. And when you then start thinking like that and you're going into a game and you're basically just doing the same thing, you're doing the same thing, it's very, very difficult then to go up another level or get into that part of your head where you're thinking, right, this is my role, this is what I've got to do. Motivate yourself, essentially. And yeah, that's not through a lack of effort, that's just through the fact that they're doing the same thing every day.
We were talking yesterday, Neil, and it's only dawned on me, I didn't realise it would still happen this year. On we're going to face a Leipzig team now in February, and I was thinking about the German League, and we were talking about Bayern yesterday. We said Liverpool might win the Premier League, but I doubt they win the European Cup. And I can fully understand that argument, because other leagues are looking after their clubs better than what our league are looking after us. on the 22nd of December, Leipzig played their last fixture until the 2nd of January.
Yep, winter break, 10 days.
Winter break, 10 days.
Normally it's 3 weeks, but they've compromised, but they're getting at least 10 days.
But they're still getting it. So our February one, is that gone?
Yep.
The Premier League one, gone. So you've got, what was it, about 10 days again?
They only have one domestic cup, and they only play 34 league games, the German league.
Plus a winter break.
Yep. Get your money on Bayern for the Champions League. However rocky they look right now, get your money on Bayern for the Champions League.
It just shows you, doesn't it, in terms of like what we're up against in terms of... they're one of the last clubs I'd have picked in the European draw. And just shows you the state of football. The Championship's got 5 subs, the Premier League hasn't. what's going on? Our Evertonian friends have gone, it's only for the big clubs, you've got more money, blah, blah, it makes a more level playing field. It doesn't... The smaller clubs are suffering just as badly. They can't contend with it because, yes, they have got smaller squads. So being able to get up in the game, win a 2-0 and then rest 5, that's a win. The thing, we can't take games away because the money's involved. But when you're getting into the 70th minute and both teams are almost ready to shake hands and we'll just take where we are now, so latter part of the second half, the footballers are dying on their feet. It's got to change.
Want to talk about one of the positives, and again I think it's quite interesting, the player I'm about to speak about, Lizzie, in that he hasn't actually had the mental toll of a lot of football for 2 years plus everything else that's going on, is Curt Jones, who I thought was the bright spark, full stop. I mean, if he scores that goal where he runs the length of the pitch, and it's actually a better chance towards the end than we actually give it credit for, because he's got himself in the middle of the goals, Lizzie, he's 18 yards out and he looked frustrated with himself. Yes, he's run 70 yards to get there. But, you know, if he scores that, then we are... That's all we've talked about for the entirety of this show, to be honest with you. We've chatted about Gerard Houllier, and then it's been the Curtis Jones show.
Yeah, it would have been brilliant, wouldn't it? And he was the only player who was having a go, really. The only player who looked lively and likely. And, I mean, it's sort of half-time before the Matip thing, and we realised he picked up a bit of an injury. I mean, I was calling for, you know, Oxlade-Chamberlain, who was sat on the bench, someone to be just a little bit more direct and someone to have a go. And that's what Curtis Jones done second half. You know, he took it upon himself. Henderson drops back. You know, he's in a midfield there with then obviously Gini, but then Minamino, who's, we haven't really seen him play a lot in a midfield three.
But he was all right.
He was all right, and he put himself about, and that's the thing with Minamino. Like, I find it really hard to criticise him too much because he does work hard and he tries. And he did do all right. He did keep hold of the ball a little bit. But Curtis Jones, I thought, was head and shoulders above everyone. And that chance, honest to God, if it would have gone in... I think Liverpool would have been absolutely bouncing. Yeah. But
substantial meals everywhere.
Substantial meals everywhere. Scotch eggs, get them out, you name it. And it's a shame, but to be honest, like, did that come after the penalty?
Yeah.
So for me, up until the penalty, I didn't even feel like a chance like that would have happened. Do you know what I mean? I felt like it took a bit of luck. It took a penalty to sort of, for that sort of opportunity to then come up, but I just felt like we didn't have enough in us to go on and win the game. And like I say, as much as he's a great little player, Curtis Jones, you know, you'd be expecting it from other players to be taking on that responsibility, and they didn't. But no, that is the positive, I suppose, and it's nice to feel like he's a first team player now.
He did look like the player who's been rotated, you know. I think that's the thing I can say in fairness to all the others, especially the likes of Wijnaldum, who looks like he's running on fumes at the moment. A guy who relies on his fitness, and that's being taken away from him a little bit, because if you're talking about level playing fields, well, we're levelling out the likes of Gini Wijnaldum. Jones is fortunate in a way, he probably won't see it this way, but he is, in terms of the fact that he has got the fresh legs on the pitch. I'm not taking anything away from him, I thought he was great. I can't believe, once he got into that position, a lot of that technical ability hasn't slotted, because he can definitely do. He's got a wand of a right foot, and yeah, it was a real shame, because it would have been a tops off moment, wouldn't it? There would have been Scotch eggs all over the show, I should say.
It would have been. The other thing I'd point out as well, across all that sort of matches, Liverpool do actually end up with a couple of the chances. Henderson should score. He only needs to do a little bit better as well to score. That's what's frustrating. It's not that he blazes it high and wide. Once Salah's executed the turn, I feel like Salah should do a little bit better. I'm not quite sure if someone just gets a flick on it to Mane just before half-time. But all of those three chances, you would expect Liverpool to put one of those three away. And they'll come just either side of half-time.
Yeah, and that's the thing with this Liverpool team is you know that because that, that quality is there, you know, we were saying before about moments where Son and Kane can literally turn it on for 40 seconds. You know that Liverpool have got those players that, that can do that. So even at 1-0 down, a part of you thinks, yes, there is going to be a few chances. But when you see, especially that Henderson one, when you see that one not go in, you, I think that was the moment when I thought, it's just not going to happen today. Because 8-9 times out of 10, he would have put that away. And frustratingly, again, nothing against Henderson, but if that had been Mane, if that had been Salah, you know, it probably would have been in. So it was just so frustrating. I'm running out of words because it was just one of those games which you just have to forget about and go, you know what, Liverpool were just not going to win this.
Okay. If you haven't had the chance yet to subscribe to the Anfield Wrap or thought about it, as the games come thick and fast, and as this league, we will talk a bit about the Tottenham game, but if Liverpool win the next two, they will actually be top on Christmas Day for all of our chat about our frustrations. They are two wins away from definitely being top on Christmas Day. You can subscribe to the Anfield Wrap, theanfieldwrap.com/subscribe for that. You can do it through the app, and we're looking at sort of doing something with the tokens around the app as well. But as you can tell by the fact that I've just sort of glossed over that, I haven't got a lot of detail in front of me at the minute, but that is to come. Yes, indeed. So do consider that if you haven't had the opportunity to do so. However, I said earlier on, I would have Rob Gutman and Ali McGovern talking about Gerard Houllier with me, and here it is. There's so much to say about Gerard Houllier and his time at Liverpool, Rob. We could be here for some time going through this, but we'll try to be relatively brief. It was the context of him restoring Liverpool as a national and European power. In some senses can be overstated, but in others it really can't be. Liverpool had not bestrode the European stage, and under Gerard Houllier they very much do.
Yeah, I remember thinking that phrase that you want to think when you've been a Liverpool fan in all the years since we were, you know, in our pomp in the 80s and before, was about getting your pride back. It seemed like a thing to want, and there was definitely a palpable sense that we had our pride was returned to us, and our pride was defined as a club by our identification with Europe. And I think Houllier was just, I don't know, symbolically, metaphorically, in every sense, he was a reconnection with Europe. He walked in as our first European manager, our first non-British manager. I have to say, I personally felt a great connection with the man. You know, there are celebrities we all, I don't know, lament the passing of. I wasn't pleased when David Bowie went, and many others, too many to name. But some you felt almost, well, I did. I felt I knew him. I really did. Probably a delusion, I'm sure, but I felt I knew the man. And I related to the fact that he was a sort of a stranger in the land of Liverpool and Scouse people, and yet embraced it wholeheartedly. Didn't even have to try. He felt naturally part of it. And I felt the same, but also a sense that you were always something of an outsider, and that's no bad thing. And I think I just related to him. This goes, I'm talking beyond football here. You've asked me a question about European cups, really, but I don't know. I'm just very, I'm in a state of shock and emotion about the whole subject at the moment, Neil. But yeah.
No, I think it's, question.
I think it is deeply emotional, Ali. I was shocked by how I took the emotion of the moment, and it was actually a reminder of the emotion felt at times during his tenure at the club. You know, he was the first manager who was aggressively hounded out in the internet era, which meant that at the same time you had a huge amount of sympathy around him. He was a manager who did everything that he did for the club, and also at a, you know, without sort of saying too much about you and I, but also at an age that for us was very, very formative. And I've interviewed the last six Liverpool managers with the exception of Hodgson, and the only one I was nervous for before, during and still afterwards was Houllier, because it was like interviewing your headmaster or your dad.
Yeah, he did have that kind of like teacher air, and famously had been a teaching assistant at a school in Liverpool, and, you know, had gone to Anfield in the 60s, so kind of knew what we were all about, really. And I think that's right. I mean, maybe this is a function of being, you know, in your kind of around the age of 20 when he arrives, that you're still at that age where football managers are an older generation that you look up to. Yeah. And he was all that, but also was our first European manager. And for me, I just really remember that shift you know, it felt like at that, in that period, like, you know, you get the Premier League starting, Manchester United are riding high. I feel like I sort of wasn't really, when I was a little kid, I wasn't really aware of football games in Europe because of obvious reasons. And then that big shift happens and all of the focus is there. And then we've got this wonderful, eloquent French manager who was just a different sort of person. You know, he wasn't a kind of Alex Ferguson hairdryer treatment or, you know, a lot of the football managers I remember when I was a kid were sort of gruff figures, whereas he was seemed so kind and seemed so, we had these young players, Michael Owen, Robbie Fowler and others, and it was like as though Julio was capable of really bringing them into a sort of team of grown-ups and making, you know, you see the pictures of him with his arms around them at a period where that was, I guess, a kind of relatively new thing in a way. But when he left the club, yeah, today felt slightly reminiscent of, you know, I could feel all of those emotions again because he really is the first manager leaving where I kind of felt angry at the people who had been frustrated with him, and I almost felt angry with the club actually. You know, I wanted it not to be true. I remember that. I remember thinking, no, just don't make it true. We can't lose Julio. And you know, we all know the story after that. But he had this massive impact on the club and often underestimated actually.
It's something, Rob, where when you talk about him, one of the interesting things about him is he's our first manager. He's got similarities to Wenger. Wenger does make some senior appearances as a footballer, but not very, very many. I think one of the other reasons why people could sort of identify with him was the idea of that love of Liverpool, that love of football that didn't come from simply or at all, particularly from playing the game at an astonishing level or anything like that. You know, he played as an amateur. Loved all of that and then wanted to involve himself in football and ends up with his managerial career. And I think that's part of why, you know, he did seem different from the outset, and seeming different and then not being successful would have been an oddity. It would have been that it obviously just wasn't right and the difference wasn't good. Because he was hugely successful, that feeling of being able to identify with him or see him as, for instance, a father figure, a start of something new and fresh, becomes all the greater, not least because he himself was in many, many ways new and fresh.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that he didn't play the game to any great level. I think it provides a greater connection with the supporters' mindset, in a sense that none of us really envisage ourselves as footballers because they're superhumans, aren't they, in a sense? That it's a level of talent we none of us has really had any right to aspire to, definitely not me. But we all think we're managers. We all think we're there for the grace of God, we can manage a little bit. And Gerard Houllier sort of, with his background, had a connection to that humanity, that sense of it's possible. Obviously, it's a delusion. He's an incredibly talented man. But I don't know, it's part of that connection. And as Ali referenced, the fact that he came from without football, he doesn't come from an English working class sports tradition, the way every other manager we'd ever known as a manager had been. As Ali said, he was a teacher. There's something unique about him. I also think the fact that he isn't British gives a different perspective. You regard him in a different sort of way. The fact that he can speak our language fluently, do you know what I mean? It's as though he's processing a lot more information than we're used to for just ordinary football managers processing,
I suppose. There was a lot of chat at the time, I remember, about whether having players of different nationalities was this, like, unassailable problem that somehow the inability of the footballers to communicate was somehow like a deep-rooted problem, and that, you know, Liverpool wouldn't succeed unless we had a team of 11, you know, Englishmen on the pitch. And I remember the way in which he brushed that off as just nonsense. You know, to me that had a massive impact. You know, we talk now about the kind of the politics of football players and football managers in a way that I don't think we did then. Although undoubtedly, you know, Shankly and others were very political, but I don't remember it being a big thing at the time. But he was quietly political about the way that he batted off that kind of parochialism.
But he also, at the same time, he was able to sort of align himself to the notion of a Scouse heart. I think he was almost the first to talk about that as well. I think Rafa goes on to do it, and Klopp certainly has. The team needs the Scouse heart, and he said it, I think, before anybody got a chance to say it. I think he did two things at once there, didn't he? Brought us that sophistication and the idea that we could be, a United Nations of a team. Although I would say, actually, to be fair, I'm thinking about this, the way I'm answering this question as I'm doing it, I think to a degree Liverpool were more receptive to that than any other club, because I go back to my youth in the mid-80s, and we had Craig Johnston, who was Australian, and Brucey Groblaw, who was Zimbabwean, and we were a mixture of Scots, Irish and Welsh, which was that was quite sophisticated for those days. So, yeah. No, it's an interesting perspective. But he definitely internationalises and modernises us as well.
Massively.
He also brings us with him on such an emotional journey, Ali, which is the trophies, and the trophies is a massive part of it. Is that feeling of having to clamber and scrabble towards our success in the 2000-2001 season, having just fallen short. He brings that journey. But that journey is also punctuated by his illness, by the severity of his illness. And I think that's something which, again, we up to that point, we sort of rarely had our managers humanised and be made vulnerable before our very eyes. And I think we're better at that now. I'd like to think anyway we can acknowledge that a little bit better now. But there was no getting away with it, getting away from it where Gerard Houllier was concerned, because he literally suffered a massive heart attack illness whilst literally managing the team on the pitch.
Yeah, and for the accounts of people who were there that day, they say, you know, I was actually in the ground that day, but the people who were there around the side of him were clear that the club doctor took important decisions, and that he managed to get to Broad Green in time, and that probably saved his life. And it was like a hugely dramatic event and moment. And I think, yes, he was human that day, but also, like, I can remember the anticipation about when the first game he was going to come back for, and what a big deal that was. And, you know, what I think the image I have of him in my mind, I suppose, at Anfield is he's the person who smiled with his whole face and very much smiled with his eyes. And I can sort of still remember him coming back to Anfield after that event, and everybody had been worried and shocked and, oh my God, what's going on? And him coming back to Anfield was this huge moment of emotion, and seeing his kind of big smiling eyes back in the ground was quite incredible. You know, that 2001, the kind of the triple season, although I was in London at the time, and can I just flag the amount of times it was referred to as the Mickey Mouse treble to me, which typical Cockneys, to which I used to say, I literally don't care if there's plastic black ears on the cup, it's silver and it's wear. you know, he was really, as Rob said before, he was the heart of that. It was difficult, and it was sometimes, we used to win ugly a lot, but he was the heart of it.
It really raised the stakes, what happened, obviously, the Leeds game and the heart operation he had. It felt very Liverpool, didn't it? In the fate has always sort of wrapped stories that are beyond just sport around Liverpool. And Julio's life and death situation just seemed very Liverpool. And also, I think, raised the stakes of our relationship with him as a manager. He was the man who literally risked his life. I think we felt it in that sense. Risked his life for the club, in as much as that he came back because he was in such a hurry to serve the cause again. That is, you know, that evening you're talking about. For me, that again, another thing that bound me to him, bound the club to him, to my mind, and made it all the sadder and sorer that time when he did have to depart. I don't care whether he succeeds or fails. He is our manager in perpetuity. I actually did feel that's the same. I have the same feeling about Jurgen Klopp early on, even before he was successful. I'd said, probably with a drink on me, I don't care if we fail with Jurgen Klopp. I just want us to be with Jurgen Klopp. And I very much felt that way about Gerrard too. I felt safe with Gerrard.
Yeah, I think that is very true. I remember having that emotion massively. Like, I don't care if we win the league, he's our manager. Which, you know, obviously, like, cold-hearted football supporters who are more rational than me and Rob would say is completely mad. But that is how it felt.
Thank you very much to Ali and to Rob. Let's get back over. Both Arnold and Salah go off in the game. This is one of those draws, I just said before we spoke to Rob and Ali, Paul, this is one of those draws which is, ultimately, if Liverpool beat Tottenham and then beat Palace, we're all going, well, you'd have took 7 points across the course of the week, and now look, we are top going into Christmas. And that's the point here, isn't it, that ultimately if Liverpool have had one eye on Tottenham, we're not that happy about it necessarily, but then, well, there's a thing to do, which is beat Tottenham.
The Trent and Salah thing, going off thing, I mean, I'll just quickly, I'll never understand this team selection and against Midtjylland as long as I'm involved in football. But yeah, I don't get that. Like, Salah happened to go off on the 82nd minute, was it?
83rd, yeah.
When you're pushing for a win against a team you should beat, because he's played in a game where you've already won the group, he hasn't done himself any favours, the manager. I will literally go to bat for him all day long. I think his wider point all season has been absolutely spot on. But why has he even travelled? I just don't get it. I won't get it. I know there's registration things and whatnot to consider, but you can play anyone who's under 18 or 21, can't you? Under sixes.
I think it's sharpness, and that's why I do think the focus thing is a really valid point. I think Liverpool want Salah and Trent as sharp as they can for Tottenham. And my point there is then it's hard then to say to the players, well, you've got to focus on number points of criticism. Yeah. You've got to focus on Fulham. You'd be a bit like, well, you're not focusing on Fulham, you're focusing on Tottenham. If you know what I mean. Like, literally, I think that's what he's done. I think he's wanted, I think he, the work back from, how do I get the 11 I'm probably going to have to pick for Spurs as sharp as possible, absolutely run the legs off them a week before, hopefully cruise through Fulham and then have them ready to go against Tottenham, and you're like, well, then you can't criticise a lack of focus first 45 against Fulham.
I get
Fulham.
It if he takes them off at 70, but what, at 83, what's the point? No, keep him on for the full 90. You don't take him off at 83 and then say it's because he played midweek and he need, no, I'm not having that, and I hate criticising Klopp, but
weirdly in his defence, it's the only time I've never seen Salah throw his dummy out the pram when he came off.
You know why? Because I think Salah thought he was going off on 70, and I think the sports science instruction Lizzie will be, he goes off on 70, and I think Klopp's thought, I need a fucking result out of this, so I'm hanging on until the last possible moment. And I think that that's what it will be, and that's why Salah doesn't throw his dummy out, because he knows he's just got 13 minutes more
than he thought he was getting. Yeah, maybe. I mean, but if you're focusing, it's job done in the Champions League. It doesn't matter what happens there. You could, if you want rhythm, all right, he finds rhythm against Fulham, and then he's sharp for Tottenham. You don't dilute him for all three games. I'm just saying
that's what their argument is.
The argument's bollocks. The game is all about getting points, qualifying, getting through, and then winning the league. Taking them there and then not having them for the full fixture against Fulham, and then a tired Mo Salah for the game against Tottenham, which is a six-pointer, is is wrong. Basically, I do not get the manager's argument. I will welcome criticism for
the manager's argument, but my issue is, don't say they need to be better against Fulham, because you've prepped them in a way that you want them to be as good as possible
you've
against Tottenham.
Against them in a weird way.
And that to me is the difficult thing. You're trying to manage through a certain thing, Emma. That's what I think's happened, and that's genuinely, I think, the plan. And he'll took all the professional advice, and he'll have advice off the charts, but then my criticism around that then is, well, then you can't sort of, you know, this thing coming out that he's lambasted them at half-time and all of this. To be dead honest with you, if I was in that dressing room, I'd be thinking, but you're focusing on Tottenham. You're thinking about Tottenham.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair, because it's all about the mentality thing, isn't it? Because, yeah, you're looking at the Liverpool players and going, yeah, how can you focus when our manager has basically set us up for the game against Tottenham? And then also, if you're a Fulham player and you see Salah going off when you've already made it to the 83rd minute, you're riding this wave of pressure, and you see, you know, Liverpool send off one of their superstars, you're going, that's another tick in the box. Mm-hmm. We've got through another thing.
Or Trent on 68.
And then if you're a Spurs player, you're looking at that and going, Liverpool are struggling here. You know, they were that sort of out of ideas that they brought on Divock Origi for Mo Salah. So not only is it, you know, are you looking at the Liverpool players thinking that's done them harm, you're looking at the Spurs players and you're looking at the Fulham players and think that's actually helped them as well.
The one thing I would say is every December we have a team selection that he does that we all go berserk about. So it's
but
worth
that
it.
That wasn't a mad team selection, was it? That's the thing, it was a strong team. And I mean,
Michelin's into this and into Spurs. I mean, across the course of the three.
I just think, right, win that Michelin game. You know, Divock Origi comes off as a sub, comes off, he starts the game and he comes off. Why isn't he playing 110 minutes instead of Mo Salah? Like, I just don't get it. Like, I kind of understand Trent in terms of match fitness. Like, I actually do get that. No arguments on Trent. Mine is on Salah. Like, do not bring Divock Origi off and keep Mo Salah on for 110 minutes in a game that does not need to be won. Okay, maybe for money. Now, we could be going even further and deeper. We don't know if he's had instructions from higher above, which is, you know, you get, what is it, 2.5 million to win a game. We need the money. Who knows? All we know is what we see on the pitch. And for me, Mo Salah shouldn't have played 110 minutes. But then I think, I know you're saying, okay, could have been promised 70 minutes and okay, gets an extra 13. But I'm sorry, I think Mo Salah would have been fine staying on till 90.
The thing is, told us we didn't win the game.
No, I know.
that's the problem, isn't it?
It just, and the thing is, I think the Trent for Nico on 70, I understand that because I can probably see that as like a pre-planned thing, whether we were winning, losing, drawing. I think that substitution would have happened.
And Trent was struggling as well, so you can base that on performance, whereas Mo Salah was probably our most likeliest provider in terms of getting that winner.
It's hard. I think it's just because of the time he come off that it frustrated me. Like I say, I think you've got a spot on there, Emma. He sent a message to Fulham, which was, right, it was a bit of the Manchester derby, right, that's it, we're hanging our hat up now, we'll take the point and let's just, they just look like a bunch of players that were playing not to be injured, and in a way I don't blame them.
In the manager's defence on this one, and obviously I was throwing the first digs and now I'm going to try and defend them on them, is season before Origi comes on and changes the game for Liverpool or Fulham. So I wondered whether he thought, roll the dice, Origi very direct. Origi was good when he came on against Fulham the season before. Maybe he can do the same thing again. Is it the season before or the season before? The season before?
I'm not quite sure.
The season before was Milner.
He got promoted last season, didn't he?
Yeah.
But anyway, I remember being a Fulham owner, Origi coming on and doing well. So I wondered whether...
The important part of this though now is win on Wednesday. And the team now, I think to an extent, Paul, depending on where Matip is, I think it's unchanged. I'd be surprised unless Kite is closer than we think and he comes in for Jones, but that would feel really harsh given everything Kurt Jones has just done. So if Matip's fit, if it is just a back spasm and he's available, then I think that team's unchanged. Do you?
Don't know. Can it be? I don't know whether I wouldn't bank on unchanged ever anymore, really. Like Matip, I think, has got off so he can play Wednesday. Matip could have finished the game in my mind. It sounds if Joel Matip isn't ruled out with a knock indefinitely and they're talking about he'll probably play Wednesday, it's a very, very precautionary move and one where I think Liverpool felt they could afford to just wrap him up in cotton wool for a couple of days. Unchanged. There's not much you can do, is there? Can you make an argument for Oxlade-Chamberlain starting with someone else needing a rest? Like, I don't know what his condition's like. I don't know what his form of training's like. Well, I just don't think you can bank on unchanged. I mean, if you said to me that's the team you're going to put out in the week, are you happy with it? Absolutely, because I think it's about as strong as we can be. It wouldn't surprise me if Phillips started as a traditional centre half. In the week, it really wouldn't surprise me, and trying to bolster the midfield a little bit. I know Mourinho, no matter what condition Liverpool are in, Mourinho will be uber cautious. He will not want to get beat. That's as you've heard Lampard on the old BT clips when he was working there talk about it. In these big games, Mourinho's like, you know, we're running this race until the end. You do not get beaten, get knocked out of position. So I think Mourinho will be like 9 at the back on Wednesday.
Yeah, I mean, I would go unchanged. However, I've just had a random thought that perhaps Jordan Henderson playing centre-back for the half against Fulham, was that perhaps an experiment looking at what his relationship with Fabinho might be like as a potential centre-back partnership against Spurs? Because we're talking about Kane and Son having that pace, and we mentioned it before about Henderson having that recovery pace, which Nat Phillips doesn't have. So was that Klopp potentially looking at how that might work? I'm not sure. I'm not convinced by it, but I do think that could be an option. But for me, I think he goes with the same lineup. I think you have to. I don't think there's any real options in midfield. I think Oxlade-Chamberlain, I don't think he's ready to start. Who knows with Naby Keita, but I wouldn't start Keita ahead of Jones anyway.
Are you worried about Tottenham's height? That would be my thing, is set pieces.
Matt Phillips is good in the air, isn't he?
That's my one where The only change in my head I can think of, I mean, there's not many possibilities anyway, really, is there? But the only one I can think of where he might go, yeah, we could do with some a traditional get your head on the ball sort of centre-half, which isn't really his style anyway. But I wouldn't be surprised if Phillips starts on Wednesday, would not.
The only one for me would be Chamberlain, but if I think you're right, Neil. I think it's too harsh to drop Curtis. Now, the thing is, it's a shame, isn't it? Because with Jota, after the Firmino performance, where it did feel like everything broke down through him, you'd be going, right, well, let's put Bobby on the bench, having to come on and start Jota. And it feels weird to not have the Jota option, I think. Do you know what I mean? Not saying that we've been spoiled as such.
What about Kelleher? We have Frank Kelleher on that front.
Honestly, honest to God, I just feel like we've got so used to now, after so long having a front three that we've relied on so heavily and having a drop off to Divock, we've got used to it a bit this season of having a front four and one which can interchange and you don't worry. And I just feel like, as much as the brilliant the front three, they'll be fine against Tottenham. It's going to be sod's law, isn't it, that we've had a terrible game against Fulham. We'll probably give them smack Tottenham and teach them a lesson. Do you know what I mean? It's just the way. I just think, Firmino just isn't as sharp this season, unfortunately. And, you know, I love the fella, but, you know, criticism where it's due, and this would have been a perfect one for Joss to come in, but we haven't got him, so I'm going around the houses to say I think we're going to be unchanged.
The one thing that wouldn't surprise me is if he'd consider playing somebody else in a centre-half in order to play Fabinho at the base of the midfield.
I'd like to give
him the job of
Kane.
Yeah. Because this thing where Kane keeps dropping deep and moving into a certain zone, the idea that he's just Fabinho's problem all match, because what they're trying to do is they want to pull the centre-half, make the running behind, etc, etc. That's what they want to do. So you almost play Fabinho as the deepest line midfielder to almost play him as a centre-half, if you know what I mean.
You can just follow Kane around in that position, can't he? Whether if Kane's heading, spearheading as the number nine, then Sam, but if he's dropping in that sort of Harry Kane way to be the number 10, making things happen, letting some run on, well, you're not exposed, then you've still got your back four, haven't you? I think Nat Phillips will start. The more I've spoken about it, I'm pretty convinced.
I think there's a chance it might be Reece Williams and not Nat Phillips. Ooh. And the reason why is recovery pace. What you don't want is you don't want Phillips going backwards, and you don't want him also setting your line unbelievably deep, unless your plan is because you're trying to create space for Tottenham to move into to get them out, and that might be a plan.
Yeah.
But I think you wouldn't want, you know, for when they do get in, you don't want Phillips watching Son pull away from him. You want Reece Williams, who at least has got a fighting chance of being able to catch him.
It's good for your game plan as well, isn't it? Like, if you're starting a Phillips or Reece Williams this week, because he didn't really come to me, Reece Williams and Fabinho was your deep line midfielder. You know, if you do need to change things up, you can take off Phillips or you can take off Reece Williams now, and you can drop Fabinho back and bring on another option midfield, which I think is more useful than trying to think, well, we could do with Fabinho in the second half moving into midfield and bringing on a centre half. Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
How far are we off with some of the others, the likes of Shaqiri and whatnot?
What about James Milner? Because I wouldn't be surprised if he comes in, into the picture for this.
We know that Keita, I think, is out. Obviously, Tsimikas and Jota are both out. I think Milner's getting closer, but obviously the press conference won't be till tomorrow.
I don't think he'll rush anyone back.
Not for this fixture. Thinking December in general. So many that are close that might save our arse. It's unbelievable.
Well, I think that big gap between the 19th and the 27th is going to be massive for them. And that's what I think. You'll see them back for West Brom, Newcastle, Southampton, some sort of chain in amongst that. And then if there any that aren't back for Southampton, well, they're not playing against Villa in the FA Cup. And then you've got the next sort of break to get them back and get them back in. Other thing is the Champions League draw. If you haven't heard it, it's Gladbach versus City. It's Lazio Bayern Munich. It's Atletico Chelsea. It's Porto Juventus. Barcelona Paris Saint-Germain. Sevilla Dortmund. Atalanta Real Madrid. And within there, Leipzig versus Liverpool, Emma. And that's, it's not the one I would have chosen, but it wouldn't have been the bottom of my list either. I think that Liverpool can expect an intense game from Leipzig. We all don't know where we're all going to be in February and March, to be fair, physically, etc, etc. But I would expect Liverpool to get through.
Yeah, me and Lizzie were saying beforehand, Leipzig was probably 3 or 4 on our list of teams that we probably didn't want. So it's not an amazing draw, but look, it's the last 16 in the Champions League. Every team's going to be tough. There was tougher teams that we could have got. So I think it's fine. I think it's fine. It's going to be one of those games where Liverpool can't play like what they did against Fulham, I think, because they will get caught out by Leipzig. But I think if Liverpool play 85% onwards of their capability, I think they'll be absolutely fine.
It's one, Paul, where you are looking at a side that shipped five to Manchester United at Old Trafford. It's worth remembering that whilst they've just conquered United 3-2 and they are two lucky goals for United towards the end of the game. But they do concede those lucky goals. They look nervy to me as that wore on. Yes, they go relatively deep in the competition last season. It's ever so slightly circumstance. Yes, the manager's a young up-and-coming prospect who seems to know what he's about, but they shipped five at Old Trafford, and that's one of the things that's in the back of my mind.
Yeah, still, that gobshite from when he was at Hoffenheim, he didn't have rub me up the wrong way last time round.
Loads of people have said that.
Oh, I hate him. Yeah, yeah, I've had a proper grudge against him since. But no, he's clearly a talented manager, and I think a big club. Well, he's at a big club, I suppose. I know they're a new club, but obviously Liverpool have got this relationship with Red Bull as well, which makes it a little bit of an interesting one. It's two Red Bull clubs year after year, isn't it? After Salzburg this time last year. So, yeah, I think by then we'll either be absolutely broken, and it'll just be, you know, me and you playing centre half, Neil, roll back the years, or. You'd imagine we'll be in. I'd like to think you'll be in a better shape by then, because the fixtures do sort of sort themselves out a little bit. Liverpool are better than Leipzig. That's the thing to remember in this. Yes, it's a tough draw. Yes, Liverpool are going to have to be competitive. But what last 16 Champions League game are you not expected to be competitive in? So it doesn't really matter if you win the group anymore, does it? That's the thing I was looking at from that draw. Is I didn't really fancy anyone. I would have liked Mönchengladbach in terms of the romance and the relationship Liverpool have got with them, and that sort of that ongoing thing that we've got there, that would have been nice. I'm sure they would have felt the same, although it would have heightened the chances of going out.
Lazio for Lucas and Pepe.
Yeah, that would have been nice as well. But
Porto would have been the pick of the draw, really. I think, wouldn't it?
I think so. But listen, they're all there because they deserve to be there. I don't think any of them have fallen off a cliff that are in the last 16 in the domestic leagues either. So. I'm much happier than our draw than I know the likes of Chelsea will be. That's a really, really tasty draw. Yeah. Obviously, Manchester City got the bye that they wanted. It is as expected.
It is, you know, it is always going to be tough, Lizzie. But it's the good thing to remember about it, and the thing that we all need to focus in on is that it is something to look forward to. Yeah. We know Liverpool are going to be playing a big match in February and in March, and that matters. You know, seasons are here to be elongated and to be enjoyed insofar as that's possible. Now listen, it looks as though the championship, the league title, will be going all the way into March and April. I think if Liverpool had won yesterday against Fulham, there'd have been a pathway to think that it was possible for Liverpool to break away. I don't see anybody else breaking away, so I think it's likely that come February and come March we're going to be hunting down the two big trophies.
I should absolutely 100% think so. And I think as much as we're talking about the injuries now and it all feels a bit relentless, like February and March, we could have players back and we could have a decent squad. I mean, touch wood as much as you want and you can if you're listening. But like the thing is as well, you know, it's been really hard this time around with the Champions League because of the nature of the group of playing pretty much every week back to back. You know, that doesn't usually happen. Whereas, I think you said it before, Paul, before we started, it sort of goes back to normal again with the last 16. It's a bit more routine. You've got more time in between the games. You know, you can properly plan and prepare rather than just think, let's get through it, don't get injured, what's the next game? I don't think that mentality sticks with them, and they can treat, you know, both games as individual games without hopefully thinking too much about what's either side.
That's it, isn't it? I mean, when you get to that sort of latter stages of the Champions League, you almost get disappointed because it's game after game after game after game, and then you go, oh, we haven't got a game for like 16 days at this point. Well, like, it makes you wonder, like, who does these calendars? How does that happen when you're playing? Well, Liverpool played a game every day in a period last year, you know. I don't know. I think by then, I mean. Van Dijk will have had, what, 3 months training
Hopefully
by then?
More fans might be back in as well. Do you know what I mean? It's a big thing.
Every chance it's played in front of a lot of humans.
That'd be nice,
not just
wouldn't
a
few. Imagine if we get to go.
It'd be a lovely symmetry for the arrangement. Liverpool's last game in front of a full Anfield was indeed the second leg of the last 16 of the Champions League. It would be lovely if the second leg of the last 16 of the Champions League also saw a full Anfield. If you haven't subscribed to the Anfield Wrap, I mentioned it before, theanfieldwrap.com/subscribe. So many different types of shows right the way through, looking back, looking forward, and some of our sort of mad variety as well. If you're on the £7 audio stuff, do check out the video stuff. We're having a great time doing the final word and doing the Friday night and the little nugget things that come before and after the match as well. Do check them out. Thank you very much to your time, for your time today, and thank you very much for Paul's, for Emma's, for Lizzie's, and for Rob and for Ali. We shall see you all later. Sports Social Podcast Network.